The challenge, the opportunity to connect. The 1960s, a time of imagination and change, a time of anger and fear. The 1960s, a program called Challenge.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen.
Looked at our connections, our divisions, through the lens of faith. Nearly 60 years later, during these challenging times, we'll take a new look at our divisions, our connections, in a new program called Challenge 2.0. In last week's episode of Challenge 2.0, Lost Treasures, we examined the rising number of youth suicides, how children as young as 5 years old have died from suicide. This week, we explore both potential causes and effective responses. So we're going to advance this topic that we began last week on youth suicide by looking at the foundational stresses and other challenges that they're being faced. And once again, we have three wonderful panelists, and I'm thankful to each of you for joining us again. Elsie Dennis, who has become very active in advocating for more attention, more resources, and aid to counter these pressures that can lead in some cases to youth suicide, and is also a member of the Shuswap Nation. So thank you very much, Elsie. Reverend Rachel Tabor Hamilton is joining us again, pastor of Trinity Episcopal Church in Everett, and is trained in critical incident stress management. And if any title speaks to this issue, that certainly seems to. You've ministered to people in a variety of situations that could lead to suicide or post-suicide. And Ace Bulger, your professional experience, I understand, includes secondary school coach, principal, and you now work with what's called the Washington Healthcare Authority, and I hope you'll tell us more about the programs that you're doing. But thank you, each and every one of you, for being part of this. In our last program, we began to discuss the various situations that can lead to youth suicide, ways to deal with that, either for the family, friends, or anyone associated with that. We talked about the increase in such tragedies. Does this overall simply reflect the reality that the stresses on young people are expanding these days?
When young folks are talking to me about the pressures that they're feeling, it's actually one of the top things right now is climate change. And they're really feeling that that their generation is being failed, and what is there to, is there even going to be a life here to live for? Do they even want to have children? You know, what's the future look like? So there's almost this sense of sort of end times that informs some things, because they have no control over that. Or they feel like they don't, let's say that.
Right.
And they're looking for ways to be positive activists. And I think what I hear from people going to school is the sense of an increased sort of, they need to go and make a living, and are there going to be jobs for them? So it's almost like all the same stressors that adults have, but perhaps more magnified. Anything we would identify that we're stressed about, they're stressed about. But it's more magnified because of a greater sense of helplessness or inability to affect a change. Because of their age, many of them can't even vote.
So how
can they make a positive contribution to it and feel that they have purpose and have effect, real effect in the life?
Are you getting the same feeling that the stresses are expanding?
Yeah, I am. I have still two daughters. One of them is only 26, and the other one is 32. And so they're recently going through adolescence, high school, college, and watch the stresses they're going through and their friends. And I haven't been that far removed from being in the educational setting. In fact, up until this last year, I was substitute teach, preferably at the high school or junior high level. I just like that level of kids. And I would interact with them and see the pressures that they're facing. I look at it right now and say, our nation, for example, is polarized. There is no naked public square. An idea cannot be tossed out without the person being attacked personally. If you're going to go into politics now, you have to be crazy to do that, in a sense. And we have this really sort of a violent mindset one another. It's like some people have said, and you've probably heard it, that, man, this is about as divided as we've been since the Civil War. Well, imagine if we're feeling that.
Right.
What are our kids feeling? And then the social media, where there's no privacy anymore. A kid can get bullied on social media, and there's no personal sanctity anymore. So yeah, the pressures are pretty immense out there.
Elsie, what's your experience with that?
Suicide is the absence of hope.
my son had, I believe he had undiagnosed depression. Mm-hmm. And I think we put so much pressure on our children. They have to be MVP wherever they go. Mm-hmm. We can't just be happy that they're in basketball or softball or whatever. They have to be the kid who got the biggest trophy or whatever. So I think that's a stressor on their lives. Mm-hmm. And then also materialism is mm-hmm. still a stressor. And that ties into self-image. Mm-hmm. They have to have the latest electronic gadget mm-hmm. or they're not good enough. Or they have to have the best picture on a social media page. And they have to have so many likes. And they need to check every 5 minutes if they got more likes for their picture. So, you know, they're worried about their appearance. They're worried about so-and-so has this gadget. I don't have it, so I'm less than mm-hmm. my friend. So they, you know, elevate themselves by getting the gadget too or whatever. And then, you know, the fear is competition for always having to be at the top and not society and parents and all, just being happy that the child, you know, accepting the child as is. Mm-hmm. You don't have to have a row full of trophies. Yay you, because you went out there and you did it.
Yeah, mm-hmm. You're special just because you're you. Mm-hmm. Is there, and we might take a broader view of the health manifestations of this, is there evidence that any of you have seen that stress-related illnesses are increasing among young people? Anxiety, panic attacks, anything of that sort.
Well, again, if you go to the study of the Healthy Youth Survey conducted in the state of Washington, the public mm-hmm. schools for 8th, 10th, and 12th graders, yeah, you will see that there is an increase in anxiety, depression, suicidal ideation. It's definitely increasing, has been increasing over a period of the last 10, 15, 20 years. Mm-hmm. So that's... Is that the perfect statistical report? Probably not, but it's a darn good one. And it is reflective of, I think, our society as a whole, that yes, in fact, we're seeing an increase in anxiety and other mental problems, yeah.
Any other perspectives on that?
I know that in my church, for example, when I've had people come to me, because we get a lot of mental health folks mm-hmm. who are kind of looking for a community to be accepted that is willing to look past that stigma. Mm-hmm. But because for them, it's very important to be able to talk about that aspect of who they are. And so one of my things is, okay, what I'm going to say to you is I want you to be as involved as you want to be. And here's my conditions mm-hmm. that you are actively pursuing the treatment plan that's been provided to you,
right.
That you're going to do that. So then, because here's why I think it's so important as we lift up diverse people of all kinds into leadership. We want people who are modeling for people who are struggling with depression and all these kinds mm-hmm. of other issues, who are trying to engage and are saying these things out loud. And because now that this person is in a key position of leadership, they're able to inform me this person is struggling because they can see it
right.
in a way that I can't. Or, you know, this student over here in an acolyte program could use this kind of support. Mm-hmm. Or this student is having, we do have a lot more incidents, I believe, of little panic attacks and anxiety mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. being in front of people. And so I think churches and other venues can be an environment that can be committed to creating safety, a mm-hmm. safe place for young people to be experimenting and being who they are and talking out loud about who they are.
Elsie, any thoughts on that?
I read that 16.2 million people each year have some kind of depressive episode. And that, to me, speaks volumes. I think we isolate ourselves and always try to put our best face forward. Mm-hmm. But inside, we may be feeling like we can't go on or we're a burden to someone. And so I think we need to always dig deeper.
How do these pressures vary from one cultural group to the other? Are they the same across the various cultural groups, or do they differ?
I think one of the reasons we see our highest rates among a Native population mm-hmm. That is disproportionate to the representation of that population in our country has to do with a little bit you referred to in our previous talk about epigenetics. And we know that historical trauma can mm-hmm. be encoded mm-hmm. in our DNA. And when someone says, you know, that was long ago, there's a real way in which inside us it's still very much informing who we are. And when Elsie speaks to issues of identity and young people struggling for understanding who they are in the world, mm-hmm. and for a lot of Native American youth who are on a reservation system, there's just so many cultural layers of feeling guilt about even the idea of trying to leave that reservation, mm-hmm. A lot of trouble about even how to be well, mm-hmm. in an environment that in many minority populations and dominant culture, they're in a family environment that's not healthy, mm-hmm. and can't possibly provide that modeling or that support. And again, the question becomes, if we have communities who are living in isolation, whether it's in an urban environment because of where they're living or in a reservation environment, I think how do the communities around them create bridges of mm-hmm. of understanding and compassion and willingness to help? But it requires being willing to do some cultural competency, learning about who are our neighbors so that we can get engaged with them and their needs in ways that are respectful. To me, so much of the anxiety and what you were talking about, even in the public marketplace of argument, we're losing a sense of human dignity. Mm-hmm. So if we're not able as adults to figure out how do we preserve that, encourage that for one another and ourselves, our young people are not going to get the modeling they need about why it's important to preserve human dignity. It begins there for me. Addressing community health or individual health. Mm-hmm.
And Elsie, that speaks very much to your experience in working within your group and community. How do you see that as an issue that we need to be aware of from one cultural group to another?
As a Native American woman, I can remember my son and I were at a mall and we had to step aside several times when we were walking. And finally, and my son was a tall kid. He was mm-hmm. 6 feet tall. And finally he said to me, he goes, "Mom, why are we always the ones who have to get off the way?" Mm. So there's that element of racism that children of color deal with every day. And I was in a group and someone else said, "Well, that's happened to me too." And basically discounting what I had tried to share.
Right.
And I think the difference is it happens all the time for us. Mm-hmm. As people of color, it's a daily thing. It's not a once in a while ouch thing. Another time my son shared with me that his school was having a cultural fair, mm-hmm. and they had male fancy dancer in his full regalia, mm-hmm. and he was dancing, and a couple of the boys turned around and looked at my son and did that war whoop, mimicked the war whoop sound, and it just took away from that joyous feeling that he had, mm-hmm. about being proud that there, you know, there was an element of his culture being shared, and then someone turned around and made it into a stereotype.
What is needed at that moment then?
I think having the family and community reassure that child that, you know, that's important, mm-hmm. and always be proud of your culture, because that is your basic foundation, is your mm-hmm. culture.
Does that also speak perhaps to where that took place in school, where students need to feel comfortable that they will get a supportive response from the educators and perhaps some intervention there? Ace, you've been in that field for decades. What's your reaction to that?
Well, what in any school that I've been involved with, and I was privileged to actually plan a school for a year and then build it up, and we mm-hmm. put the operating principles in, and that would be, what are the characteristics of a middle school kid? Mm-hmm. What are parents' needs? What are students' needs? And how are we going to treat each other so that if you walk into the school, you've said, "I feel this is a place of community, you're welcome, it's safe, and people can express themselves and grow into who they're supposed to be." Mm-hmm. So the reality is that everywhere we go, every organization is made up of human beings. Some of them are flawed, we're all flawed, mm-hmm. just depends on to what degree and how willing you are to improve yourself. So the best you can do, in my opinion, is gather people around you who are willing to dialogue to make a situation better all the time, mm-hmm. starting with me. Right. How can I be better? And then if you surround your people, surround yourself with people in a school setting like that, including your teachers. When I was a principal, and I thought the most important thing I could do was hire the very best, because I knew that they were going to be with that kid every day mm-hmm. for hours, and they were the most significant person in that person's life for an hour or two a day. And so I wanted to hire the very, very best who had those kinds of compassionate mm-hmm. abilities to empathize, to flex, to treat the individual student as an individual, a strong challenge, but very doable. Mm-hmm. And I think when you have a team, a school that agrees upon those concepts and holds themselves accountable to it, that's how you begin to make a mm-hmm. difference. So you go out there in society, walking down the sidewalk, that's another entirely huge problem. Mm-hmm.
And that begs a question, I think. Let's say, in the instance of your son or anybody else that's in a situation of that sort, that there's inappropriate behavior that mm-hmm. takes place. You can, let's say, in the best of situations, the student feels comfortable going to an educator, an adult mentor, and they can deal with that in the school, but then you have the child maybe that perpetrated that act goes home. How do you counteract what's going on in the home that may be supporting that behavior in the first place?
Go to a good church that's going to yeah. talk to you about diversity, inclusivity, and the ultimate love of God. I mean, a way that just says, if we can't address the issue as a family unit, mm-hmm. and then there is going to be no hope for that child. They will be in a genuinely hopeless situation. Mm-hmm. And sometimes our runaways are coming out of environments that are so heinous yep. that jumping into the fire from the cauldron is the easier thing to do.
Right.
And so, okay, if they've jumped out of the pot, where are we going to catch them? Where are we mm-hmm. going to get that net? And being just kind, we have a high rate of teen homelessness.
Yep.
And so recognizing that as an opportunity to have a couple of seconds of exchange of acknowledging mm-hmm. them as a person and remembering that they are a child, and what do they need is adults that care.
Right. Mm-hmm. We've heard the term helicopter parenting. Mm-hmm. We've heard the terms tiger mom, tiger dad. Mm-hmm. Maybe you might provide some explanations of those terms and how those can contribute to stress or the complications that stem from stress.
I think you named earlier that performance anxiety begins early.
Right, right.
Give you an example of when I was a principal of a middle school. We had kids were just coming from an elementary to a middle school. And so they actually started getting grades in some classes, not all, but some in the sixth grade. Mm-hmm. Seventh and eighth grade grades, yes. Sixth grade, some of them are just still pass, fail, satisfactory, not, but some grades. This one young fellow is in sixth grade. Was a pretty sharp kid, but happened to get a B. And the parents came in and demanded a parental principal session because their kid would not get a B. It was going to wreck his chance to get into Harvard.
Mm-hmm.
And you're kind of, your jaw drops in a way. You don't dare
right.
because you want to respect the parent, but you're thinking, wow, much less the parent. How about the kid? What's going to yeah. happen to him? And we do know down the road when you have that kind of stressor that those kinds of kids do become susceptible to suicide. Mm-hmm. That kind of pressure is unreal. It's not normal. It's not happy. So, some of the helicopter parents, you know, to me, I'm a dad, not the best dad maybe, but I sure tried. And that would be to say, try to let your kids do what they can on their own and support them. And where they can't, you step in and you know where you need to intervene. In other words, pick your battles, you know, but let them get beat up a little bit. Don't try to pave the way for them. That's not the way it is out there. You know, it's like, be with them, support them, love them, you know, but also let them go, let them live.
As a parent, Elsie, and I'm a parent too, with an adult son, when you see somebody else is putting unrealistic expectations on a child, and maybe you're son or daughter is taking that to heart. Is there anything in your experience that has been useful both for you to talk to your son or daughter, or maybe to interject or interact with the other parent in a gentle way to maybe get them to just back off and de-escalate the pressure a little bit?
Well, for our family culture, I think we work with our child. I wouldn't necessarily go to another parent and say, hey, knock it off. But just reassuring the child or my child that it's not them necessarily. It's the other person's issue that person right. needs to deal with, and it's not my child's issue to deal with. And separate that out for them.
Mm-hmm. Rachel, any perspectives you'd offer on that?
I had a young woman in my office of a parishioner's family who was aggravated about a lot of things, which is pretty normal in adolescence, right? Mm-hmm. And so giving that person space to be able to express exactly what she was feeling without editing it. Mm-hmm. She used some very colorful language. Mm-hmm. and it's not my job to say, don't do that, because that's not the moment. It's, okay, how do you really feel? And giving them the space to be that, exactly as they are. And in the course of that, she said, I should just kill myself. Mm. Now, it could have been a cast-off line.
Right.
But I said to her, you need to know I'm a mandated reporter when someone ever says that they intend to harm someone else or themselves. Mm-hmm. So I need to tell your parent. And she said, but I don't mean it. I said, your language creates a reality. And shortly after that, she had a friend that died. And then, you know, kind of talking to her later, she said, you're right, the language matters. And because I called her parents and said, she's feeling pretty stressed out, and mm-hmm. she's just kind of threw this out. So you might want to have a conversation
right.
together and allow her to be herself. Because if you start editing and auditing who she is, how is she going to trust you with the things you need to trust down the road?
I might ask, as we wrap this up, because unfortunately the clock keeps going on and there's so much more we could talk about, in each of your experience, and each of you have had to deal in very stressful situations, techniques, methods, actions that have been very useful to you or to young people that you know that you would recommend for others to consider?
I think it's important to have your child be part, this is going to sound strange, but to be part of your life and not just be bringing the child along, mm-hmm. but to have the child comprehensively in your life. I think too often social media becomes the babysitter, the electronic right. babysitter. So as Rachel said, it's time to put down the phones and be one with nature. There's that disconnect from community. Mm-hmm. When we were growing up, our thing to do was to leave the house and get lost in the woods.
Yeah, that was my case.
And yeah. I think when you connect with nature, you feel responsibility for nature. Mm-hmm. And I think that goes back to the earlier issues we were talking about, climate change and things like that, that would help our young people.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know that certainly speaks to the experience. I think also, and you bring up a very good point, is parents feel, well, I need to disconnect from my children so that I can earn more money and give them the sort of life I want to. But in fact, that may be a false achievement. It may be that time with the child is actually much more beneficial. I think that's a really good point. Rachel, what would be your perspective on that?
Well, adding on to that, we just had the set of readings that talk about, you know, when we invest so much of our lifetime into our wealth accumulation, mm-hmm. we're missing on the investment of our relationship, and that's where the real riches are. I'd rather have a family with a little bit less income and more time with me. Yeah. Keeping the communication open, though, and adjusting that communication with each grade level as the children are getting older is probably so crucial. The most crucial element is, how can I talk to you now? And how can you promise to talk to me now?
Mm-hmm. Ace.
Well, I think that you mentioned it both very well, and that is relationship. You know, I have a picture of Rachel when she was 3, my little baby. Mm-hmm. And then when she was about 20, 21. And what I miss is the relationship not what things she accumulated or what things I could give her. It was the relationship I missed. So that's really where the focus is. And I've talked to parents who have, in some cases, kissed their children off and said, "Ah, they're lost. I'm not gonna." Mm-hmm. And I said, "You don't want to go there. Believe me, it's one thing to say it when they're just being difficult. It's another thing to lose a relationship." And so, to me, life is about relationships, mm-hmm. and from that, everything else flows. So, yeah, I would reinforce, develop those relationships, develop those relationships.
And we disconnect from people all too
quickly. All the time.
And if we're going to say life is sacred, we have to do the sacred walk together.
There you go. Yeah, well said.
Well, thank you so much. There's so much more we could go, and I suspect we will in yet another program. But thank you so much for sharing your perspectives and your wisdom on this issue, and we hope that maybe it's allowed people to get some ideas in terms of countering some of the stresses for themselves and for their children. So thank you again very much.
And
thank you for joining us. We hope you'll join us again next week on Challenge 2.0. If you've enjoyed this program, please give us 5 stars and leave a review. If you can also tell one friend about the show, that would be great. You can find us on social media at Facebook, YouTube, Instagram, and Twitter. You can find out more and financially support the show at PathsToUnderstanding.org. The program is hosted by executive producer Jeff Renner, produced by Tom Butterworth and John Sharifi. Cameras and audio by Richard McAdams, Tom Butterworth, and Dean Cuccio. Ian Olson is the production assistant.